Last time we talked about Leviticus. Today we're going to talk about Numbers and Deuteronomy. As I mentioned last time, Leviticus and Numbers are probably tied for being the most unread books of the Bible, but Leviticus is actually a little bit more difficult than Numbers. Although what happens in Numbers is the title is not the most appealing title that you might encounter. It just doesn't sound like it's probably going to be very interesting. But also it begins with a census. And so reading through that census can be very tedious. But if you have some idea of what the structure of the book is, I think it makes it a little easier to understand where you're going. Another thing I would say is when you're going through a part of the Bible like that, where there's a lot of stuff that's not so easy to read, it's not a bad idea to listen to the audio version of it, which you can do online. If you go to the Bible Gateway, you can listen to the King James Version being read for nothing. And if you just start on Leviticus chapter 1, for example, and hit play, it'll go all the way through the book. But the book of Numbers, it comes from the Greek title of the book, which is Arithmi in the Septuagint. And that's because of the two censuses. There's one at the very beginning of the book, and there's one at the end. Why are there two censuses in the book? Well, basically, the first census says, these are the people who came out of Egypt. But then, as you know, if you're familiar at all with the story of the Bible, God became angry with these people, and he said that they weren't going to enter the Promised Land. So that final census is there because this is not that first group, except for two people, and that's Caleb and Joshua, who are the two spies that gave a positive report of the land. The Hebrew name of the book is actually In the Wilderness, which comes from like the fifth word of the book in Hebrew. But it's actually a fairly descriptive title, which gives you an idea of what's going on, because it starts off with them at Mount Sinai. So in the book of Exodus, you have the plagues and all that. The people leave Egypt, and then they come to Mount Sinai, and they get the law. The book of Leviticus is kind of an aside. I mean, it really departs from the historical narrative, and it's all about what we talked about last time. And it's the fact that it's the middle book of the five books of Moses is not probably coincidental, because it's basically that book itself is structured in a chiastic way, as we talked about last time, where there's the midpoint, which is the emphasis of the book, is the Day of Atonement. So the fact that Leviticus is right sandwiched between two books on one side and two books on the other side, I don't think is accidental either, because it's saying this is the most sacred part of it. But the book of Numbers begins at Mount Sinai, so the first 10 chapters are all about them being at Mount Sinai, the census, and then preparing to depart. And then you have two journeys. One, chapters 10 through 12, you're journeying to the wilderness of Paran. And then there's another journey, that's 13 through 19, is that stay in that area. And then the next journey is chapter 20 to 21, and that's the journey to Moab. Now, you shouldn't get the impression from that they just made one stop, because they actually did a very circuitous thing. But there were these two, there's Sinai, there's Paran, and Moab is right across the Jordan as they're getting ready to go into the Holy Land. And so these three locations, there's a great deal of emphasis about those particular stops. And then you have a conclusion that goes from chapter 33 to 36. So the first part, to talk about it in a little bit more detail, chapters 1 through 10, you have the census in chapter 1. And then chapters 2 and 4 talk about the organization of the camp, because the tabernacle was in the middle. That was where all the worship was taking place. And the tribes were laid out in a form that actually looks like a cross, very interestingly. And then the chapters 5 through 6 have special laws that are talked about. Talks about those who were excluded from the camp. It also talks about the ordeal of jealousy, which was if a husband suspected his wife of committing adultery, he could take her to the temple. They would take some dust from the floor of a tabernacle and put it into something for that person to drink, and they would basically pronounce a curse on themselves if they were lying. And if nothing bad happened, then they were considered to be innocent. But if something bad happened, then they were considered to be found guilty. Then you have the Nazarite vows, which are sort of a foreshadowing of monasticism. And then you have talk about the priestly benediction, which one thing it doesn't talk about in the text itself, but is very interesting to know, and that's that to this day, if you go to a Jewish synagogue, there are some people who have the last name Cohen. Whenever you meet someone whose last name is Cohen, you're dealing with someone who's a descendant of the tribe of Aaron, or the family of Aaron, and they're a Levite. There are some people who have the name Levi or Levit. Those are people who are Levites. So these families have preserved these names because the Jews have this hope that one day they'll be able to revive the temple worship. But in a synagogue, even to this day, when a Cohen is present, he says this benediction that's talked about in the book of Numbers in chapter 6, and he does his hands like this, and he pronounces his benediction over the people. And Leonard Nimoy, being a Jew, that's where he got the live long and prosper for the Vulcan. So if you're ever wondering what the story is behind that, that's where it came from. And then chapter 7 through 8 talk about the offerings to dedicate the tabernacle, because the tabernacle was constructed in Exodus. Here it's dedicated. And then chapter 10, verse 10, talks about the celebration of the first Passover after the original Passover. So this is the first commemoration of that event. And it also talks about the cloud that would be over the tabernacle when they were supposed to stay, but when it was time for them to leave, the cloud would depart. So they would follow the cloud, and that's the reason why they wandered around, because God would not lead them into the land after they rebelled against him. We'll talk about that in just a minute. And then it talks about silver trumpets that were made to announce certain feasts and that sort of thing. And then chapters 10, verse 11 through 12, verse 11 through chapter 12, I should say, is the journey from Sinai to the wilderness of Paran. So the chapter 10, verse 11 through 36 talks about the actual departure. And then it begins with verse 34, it says this: "And the cloud of the Lord was upon them by day when they went out of the camp, and it came to pass when the ark set forward that Moses said, 'Rise up, O Lord, and let thine enemies be scattered, and let them that hate thee flee before thee.' And when it rested, he said, 'Return, O Lord, unto the many thousands of Israel.'" And I talked about this in a sermon sometimes back. It's because there's this in the Psalms, there's that psalm which we hear on Pascha quite a bit, "Let God arise and let his enemies be scattered." And that comes from this, because that psalm was related to the temple worship and the processions that they would have with the ark. And one thing about that is it says that they would do this at the beginning of the day. They would say one prayer. At the end of the day, they would say another prayer, which goes to show that there was liturgical worship, repetitive prayer, and they didn't see that as being a problem.
If you go to, you know, Jewish synagogue today, they still have liturgical practice.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you go to Jewish synagogue worship, a Jewish synagogue service is a lot like the liturgy without the Eucharist, because that's basically what a liturgy is. It's a Jewish synagogue worship followed by a habura meal, which is a Jewish fellowship meal that involves bread and wine. Then in chapter 11, you have the people beginning to complain. And so this is a theme throughout this book. And then Moses' father-in-law tells him, "Look, you're taking too much on yourself. You know, you need to delegate some authority." So he suggests that he appoints people who can hear smaller matters of people, you know, when they had some minor dispute, so he didn't have to hear all the controversies of the people. So that's when Moses appointed 70 elders who were consecrated at the tabernacle, and they all began to prophesy. And there's a story that we read about on the day of, on the vigil for Pentecost, where it says there were two people near the camp that were not part of the 70. They started to prophesy also, and Joshua came to Moses and said, "Hey, Moses, tell these people to stop, because they're not part of the 70. And Moses made the statement, "Would that all the people were prophets, and the Holy Spirit was on all of them," which is seen by the church as a foreshadowing of what was to come in the New Testament. And then chapter 12, there's a very interesting story that involves Moses' Ethiopian wife, which is an interesting chapter for a number of reasons. One is, it's not uncommon for people to raise a question about what about interracial marriage. Well, from the church's perspective, there's only one kind of mixed marriage, and that's when an Orthodox Christian marries someone who's not Orthodox. And we will allow it if they're a Christian who believes in the Trinity with the blessing of the bishop, but it's absolutely forbidden if that person is not a Christian who believes in the Trinity. So when two Orthodox Christians marry, if they're of totally different races, it doesn't matter at all as far as the church is concerned. Well, in Moses' case, he, as I think I mentioned when we were talking about the book of Exodus, in the movie, The Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston, there's the opening scene where Moses is coming back in triumph from having conquered the Ethiopians, and there's this little interaction between the Ethiopian princess where it makes you kind of wonder, hey, is there something going on here? And that was just sort of that movie's little allusion to the Jewish tradition that Moses married an Ethiopian princess as a result of this campaign that the Egyptians waged that he led. And when he fled into the Sinai desert after he killed the Egyptian, he did not take that wife with him. He married Zipporah. But when he came back into Egypt, at some point, he obviously was reunited with this wife, and she came with him out of Egypt. But this is the first mention of this woman that you have in the Bible. So it just says Aaron and Miriam were criticizing Moses about his Ethiopian wife. It doesn't tell you where this wife came from or what it is exactly that they didn't like about her. But God told basically Aaron and Miriam that they were wrong, and Miriam in particular was struck with leprosy for one day. Moses interceded on her behalf and she was cured, but that was God's way of saying, you know, don't mess with Moses. And then you have the next section, which is chapters 13 through 19, where they're in the wilderness of Paran. And in chapter 13, that's when they send the spies into the land, the promised land, one representative of each tribe. So had the people been obedient and had faith, the Exodus story would have been a very short story. They would have gone into the land, they said, hey, we can do this, God's with us. They'd have gone in, and then you'd be already in the book of Joshua. But instead, 10 of the spies came back, and they said, oh, these people are like giants in the land, and we're like insects in their presence, and how can we possibly defeat these people? But Joshua and Caleb came back and saying, look, it's a good land. It's a land of milk and honey. With God on our side, we can do it. So chapter 14, it records the rebellion of the people, because the people are saying, hey, we're not in on this. You know, we didn't come out here to be killed by these Canaanites. So they reject the idea of going into the land at that point. Well, God tells Moses, he's so mad at these people who rejected his promise, look, you know, just let me wipe these people out and I'll start a new people, and of your descendants, raise up a new people, because I'm tired of these folks. But Moses intercedes on their behalf, and so God doesn't wipe them out. But then when the people realize that they've displeased God, they decide, well, hey, we'll go ahead and invade the land anyway, even though God swore in his wrath, as it says in the Psalms and quoted in the book of Hebrews, that he would not allow them to enter into the promised land. They went ahead and tried to do it anyway, and it wasn't successful. They basically got their tails handed to them, and so they came back in defeat. So this is alluded to in the Epistle to the Hebrews, chapter 3, beginning with verse 8. It says, harden not your hearts as in the provocation in the day of temptation in the wilderness. When your fathers tempted me, proved me, and saw my works 40 years, wherefore I was grieved with that generation and said, they do always err in their heart, and they have not known my ways. So I swear in my wrath, they shall not enter into my rest. Take heed, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God. So this is one of many allusions you find in the New Testament to the book of Numbers, and particularly to this rebellion. In the Psalms, you have a number of allusions to this as well. And the lesson is that when God promises something, we have to take him at his word. We have to believe him and be willing to step out in faith, because God doesn't hold out his promises forever. You know, it's not like we get unlimited numbers of chances to finally come around. Then chapter 15 talks about various laws. Chapter 16 talks about another rebellion. This is the rebellion of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. Now, in the movie The Ten Commandments, what was it, Edward G. Robinson, or what's the name of that actor that plays Dathan? Is that him? Okay. But he was the guy who played the gangster in the 1930s movies. You dirty rat! And, well, anyway, he's, you Moses, you dirty rat! You know, it's basically what you see in that movie. Really? Really? Well, he's Dathan. Well, in chapter 16, you have Dathan, Abiram, and the sons of Korah, who say, Moses, you take too much on yourself. All the congregation is holy. It's not just you and Aaron. And so basically you had the first Southern Baptist appear in Scripture, where they were saying, look, we don't believe in this whole idea of ordained clergy. Everybody's holy. The whole nation is holy. And the thing is, if you look in the law of Moses, there are places where it talks about you are a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. And that's repeated several times in the New Testament. So it was true then, and it's true now, but there was still a distinct appointed priesthood that had certain responsibilities. And so you couldn't just take on those responsibilities if you had not been authorized to do so. And so these people, you know, God speaks through Moses and tells the people, look, don't get away from where they are, because where they are is where the wrath of God's about to fall. And of course, they're wiped out. And then the next chapter, chapter 17, you have another thing where people were disputing about Aaron and his priesthood. And so God told Moses to have Aaron and then representatives of all the other tribes to take their staves, their walking sticks, and put them in the ground in the court of the tabernacle, and he would show who he had appointed to be the priest, and Aaron's rod budded, and so that showed that he was the one that was chosen by God. And if you pay attention to the vigil, there's fairly regularly in the church year we commemorate the cross, and actually, basically, throughout the month of August, we hear this katavasia very often, and then also in September, leading up to, and then in the after feast of the exaltation of the Holy Cross, there's this line of the katavasia. It says, the rod of Aaron is an image of this mystery, for when it budded, it showed who should be priest. So in the church that once was barren, the wood of the cross hath now put forth flower, filling her with strength and steadfastness. The rod that budded is also talking about in terms of the Virgin Mary, because here you had a lifeless stick that buds. And it's not to say that the Virgin Mary was lifeless, but that she was a virgin. So there wasn't any natural way that she could have a child, but she did. And so this is seen as an image of the virgin birth. Then in chapter 18, they talks about the responsibilities of the priest. In chapter 19, it talks about the red heifer, which was a very important sacrifice that they offered. And then chapters 20 through 21 is again another narration of another journey from the wilderness of Paran, leading you up to the final stop in the plain of Moab, right across from the Jordan River. So chapter 20, it talks about the waters of Meribah. And this is where the people are getting thirsty. Earlier on, the people were complaining, we don't have any food. So they're getting manna already, but then we're tired of this manna, so God sends them quail. Well, here they're saying, we're thirsty, you let us out here to die. So God tells Moses to go strike this rock, and water would come forth. And so it says, beginning with verse 10, and Moses and Aaron gathered the congregation together before the rock, and he said unto them, hear now, ye rebels, must we fetch you water out of this rock? And Moses lifted up his hand, and with his rod he smote the rock twice, and the water came out abundantly, and the congregation drank, and their beast also. And the Lord spake unto Moses and Aaron, because ye believe me not to sanctify me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore ye shall not bring this congregation into the land which I have given them. Now, I mention this story because this explains why Moses doesn't enter into the promised land. You might say, well, what did Moses do that was such a big transgression? Well, God told him to simply go and strike the rock, and then water would come out. But he feels a need to scold the people and say, you know, listen, you rebels, must we fetch water for you out of this rock? And the way that he words it, Blessed Theodoret says he's sort of expressing doubt as to whether it's even going to happen. So he's not really sure that God's really going to do it. And also he hits it twice in anger, twice as if once wouldn't be enough. And so God is saying, look, because you didn't do what I told you to do, you're not going to be able to cross the Jordan into the promised land. And then towards the end of that chapter, we have Edom refusing to allow the Israelites to pass through that their land. And so they go around. And then at the beginning of that chapter, it actually talks about the death of Miriam, Moses' sister. At the end of this chapter, it talks about the death of Aaron. So both of Moses' siblings die in this one chapter. And then in chapter 21, you have the victory of the Israelites, and that's the defeat of King Sihon and Og, who were Canaanite kings. And then and then in chapters 22 through 32, this is where they're in Moab. And it begins with the king Balak, who is the king of Moab, who's upset because there's this big army of people coming into his kingdom and he doesn't know what to do. So he contacts Balaam, who's a pagan prophet. And if you're familiar with the story of Balaam, Balaam is getting ready to go and curse the people because that's what Balak is asking him to do. And so he gets on his donkey, but his donkey reaches a certain point and stops. And so he's hitting this donkey, he's getting out his stick and he's beating this donkey. And finally the donkey turns to him and he says, you know, what have I ever done to you that you're doing this? So this is Balaam's ass that spoke, is what the story is. Well, there was an angel of the Lord that the donkey could see because the donkey wasn't a sinner. So he could see the angel, but Balaam could not see the angel. Basically, the donkey wound up saving Balaam's life. And so he was told, look, you're not going to be able to curse the people of Israel. So instead of cursing the people of Israel, he actually pronounces blessings over the people of Israel. And he also prophesies of the coming of the Messiah. And then in chapter 25, you have the incident of the Baal of Peor, and this is where the people were falling into idol worship and fornication with Midianites. And there was a priest by the name of Phinehas, and he saw this one Israelite taking a Midianite woman and basically committing fornication out in the open. And he was so filled with zeal that he picked up a spear and he pinned the two of them to the ground, and that was when a plague that had begun stopped. But even up to that point, 24,000 people were told were struck dead by this plague because the people were sinning against God. So chapter 26 has the second census, and this is the next generation, which is not to say that these people were saints in comparison to the first generation, but they had at least not refused to go into the land like their fathers had done. And then there's a very interesting story in chapter 27, and it's referred to again towards the end of the book. And it's talking about the daughters of Zelophehad, I guess is the way you would pronounce it. But basically, their father had died in the wilderness, but he didn't have any sons, but he had daughters. And their daughters came to Moses and said, look, our father's dead, he doesn't have any sons. Shouldn't we get some inheritance? Because otherwise, then my father's, you know, inheritance is gone. And so Moses agrees with him. So he goes ahead and he gives these daughters an inheritance, which is a very interesting story. And then Joshua is appointed as Moses' successor. And then in chapters 28 through 29, there's a departure where they're talking about different offerings that are done at different celebrations that are either daily, weekly, or annual. And then in chapter 30, it talks about vows that women make. And basically, what that's all about is, like, if a woman is still in her father's house and she makes a vow, it says that if her father doesn't object to it, then she's bound by the vow. But if her father says she shouldn't have done that, then the vow is not binding. And the same thing if she's married. Then in chapter 31, it talks about the war with the Midianites. And then chapter 32, it talks about the inheritance that tribes that were going to live on the side of the Jordan River that they were on would inherit. So there's some people who are already beginning to get their inheritance, but basically they have to promise that when their help is needed to fight the Canaanites, they're going to go and fight. They're not going to just sit in their inheritance and not help the other people.
What was their inheritance? Land?
Yeah. And also, we come back to this at the very end of the book, so I'll finish up on talking about these daughters in just a minute. But the chapters 33 through 36 gives us the conclusion of the book of Numbers. And it's chapter 33 reviews where they've been, and it also, Moses is giving them directions on how they should proceed as they go into the land. And then chapter 34 basically divides up the land according to the tribes and tells them what they will inherit. 35 talks about the cities that Levites would have, because they didn't have their own separate land, but they would have certain cities that they would live in. And then also cities of refuge, that someone who, if you killed someone accidentally, you could go to a city of refuge, and then their relatives couldn't come and kill you to get revenge if you were in that city of refuge. And of course, any one of these things we could go into great detail talking about, because there's a lot of symbolism in the city of refuge. There's a black spiritual song about this that kind of tells you a little bit about it, but the analogy is that it's kind of like you need to come to Christ or else, is what the city of refuge story is all about, is we're liable to punishment unless we get to where we need to be. And then the very final chapter, chapter 36, they come back to the daughters of Zelophehad and their inheritance. And basically it's decided that they will have to marry men within their tribe, because if they married outside of their tribe, then those tribes might claim their inheritance. So their inheritance is protected by Moses' decision. And, you know, I haven't really read any patristic commentary on what the story is with these daughters, but it's interesting that out of all the things that they might have talked about in the book of Numbers, these daughters are talked about twice. You know, that's something I want to dig into a little bit more myself. Now, in the New Testament, there's a number of allusions to things that are going on in the book of Numbers. One thing I passed over, and I forgot to mention it when it came up, but there was the point where the people were rebelling against God, and so God sent serpents to slay the people. And Moses prayed for the people, and God said, okay, make a bronze serpent, put it on a pole, and when the people look to that serpent, they'll be healed. Well, the Gospel of John, Christ talks about this himself as being an image of his crucifixion. And there's a lot that could be said about that. I don't want to get too sidetracked in that. But the fact that it's a bronze serpent means that it has the form of a serpent, but it doesn't have the poison of the serpent. And so like that, Christ became a man, but he didn't take on it. He was not born with sin himself. He took on our sins, but he didn't have sin in himself. And then also another allusion to this: if you think about Christ feeding the hungry in the desert, in the wilderness, he did this twice. This is another allusion to this wandering in the wilderness that you have in Numbers. Also, the Sermon on the Mount is an allusion to Exodus, because Moses went to Mount Sinai and he got the Ten Commandments. Christ goes to the Mount and he gives the people the Beatitudes, and he talks about the, you know, how what was in the Old Testament is raised up to another level in the New Testament. So, far from the book of Numbers being a dry book with nothing in there, there's really a lot there, but there are certain parts of it that are not as easy to understand. Same thing with the book of Leviticus. A lot of these sacrifices, you would have to dig deep to be able to understand all the levels of meaning that's there. But whether we understand it or not, there is meaning there. And as St. Justin Popovich says, if we read something in Scripture and we don't understand what it means, we need to read it again. And then, and ask God to help us to understand it. And God will begin to reveal it to us. It does require discipline. And one thing I would say, just as a practical matter, is I think that when you're reading books like that in the Old Testament. If you don't have not already developed the habit of reading the scriptures especially, it's a good idea for you to mix some reading of that with some reading in the New Testament, just so that you don't feel like you're getting too bogged down. And also, like I said, if you're listening to the audio version of some of these parts that are not easy to read, like the parts where they're going through a census and they're talking about a very long series of genealogies, like you also get in the books of Chronicles, First Chronicles especially, I think, that will help you get past that. Because even in those genealogies, sometimes there are some interesting things that are interjected, but if you just skip over the entire section, you'll miss it. But one thing about all these lists of names that we should take from it is that these were all real people. And, you know, for the Jews, when they would read these names, these were their ancestors. And so these names had a lot of meaning to them. But what it tells, one thing it tells us is that the you know, our salvation is for us as individuals. It's not just something that's, you know, for an abstract people of God. It's for us as individuals, as part of that people. Any questions about the book of Numbers before we talk about Deuteronomy, which we won't spend nearly as much time on, partly because the book of Deuteronomy is not as difficult to understand as the book of Numbers.
I've never read the book of Numbers, so I don't even have any idea.
Right.
You know, it's
how difficult is it to start reading it?
It's not too difficult, and like I was saying, if you listen to the audio version of it, you'll have an easier time getting through some of the rough spots. But I'll tell you another thing that's good to do if you've not read the Old Testament, is if you have a book like the Law of God, when you read through it, it tells you sort of the highlights of the Old Testament, so it gives you some idea of who is who. Because as I mentioned, you know, many weeks back, reading some parts of the Old Testament is kind of like reading War and Peace. War and Peace is one of these novels that's famous for not being finished, because it's considered to be one of the greatest novels ever written, but it's a tedious novel because, for one thing, there are so many, it's very long, and there are so many characters, and particularly if you're not used to Russian culture, the fact that the same person could be called Sasha, Alexander, Petrovich, or sometimes even different nicknames for the same person, it can be very confusing. But when I watched the 4-part movie that the Soviets did in the 60s, which is actually an excellent movie, surprisingly well done for a movie that was done during the Soviet period, that helped me go back and finish the book, The War and Peace, because it gave me the idea of where the whole story was going and who the main characters were. And so when you go back and you read the book after that, it makes it easier to follow it. And the scriptures are similar in that once you become familiar with the basic flow of scripture and who's who and the main themes, when you're actually reading it, it makes it a lot easier to figure out what it is that you're reading.
Where do you get the audio of these things?
You can get it online. You could also buy like a CD set of the Bible or cassette tapes if you still have a cassette player. But online it's free. The Bible Gateway is a really good website. And if you just go and it has a place where you enter a scripture reference, you could type in Leviticus 1, and that will take you to Leviticus chapter 1. And if you're looking at the King James Version, or a couple of other versions, but I would recommend the King James, because the New King James, they don't have the audio for free. And the other versions I don't really like. If you click on the sound, there's a sound button. If you click on that, you'll have a pop-up, and it will start playing the audio. And it will just keep playing until you stop it. So you can listen to it as long as you want and pick up where you left off. But because I know, particularly if you're tired at the end of the day, sitting and reading a text, particularly if it's not easy to read, can be hard, and it's easy to just set it aside and stop. But if you're relaxing, maybe have a cup of coffee, and you're just listening to it, it's easier to do. And actually, by listening to the Bible, you're not cheating. You're hearing the scriptures the way most people in the history of the people of God ever heard the scriptures. Most people didn't own their own copy of the Bible. They heard it being read. And that's one of the reasons why the King James Bible is such an excellent version. Most translations are written for the eye and not for the ear. But the King James was written for the ear. When they translated it, they talked a lot about how it would sound and how they could make it sound better. it wasn't, they weren't just trying to make it technically accurate. They wanted to make it beautiful, and they succeeded, I think, in most cases. Okay, so the book of Deuteronomy, which is the last of the five books of Moses. Deuteronomy, it comes from the Greek word deuteronomos, which means second law. And it's called that because it's a repetition of so much of the law, so many of the laws that came before it, including the Ten Commandments, are repeated in the book of Deuteronomy. Now, in the Hebrew, it's called, these are the words, which are, that's the first two words of the book of Deuteronomy in Hebrew, which is also a fitting and descriptive title because the book of Deuteronomy consists of mostly three addresses that Moses makes to the people. So they're in the plain of Moab, which is where the book of Numbers left us. Moses is not going to enter into the Holy Land or the Promised Land because God told him he wouldn't. And so he gives three long talks to the people that are basically, these are the final instructions. Now, there's different ways to outline this book, but I'll talk about two different ways that I think explain the context, the contents of the book pretty well. We talked about, when we discussed the book of Exodus, the form of the Hittite suzerain treaty, which is something that the Hittites were a people that disappeared from the face of the earth. They ceased to be an identifiable people. But they existed around this time. And they had, there are texts that we found that lay out a covenant treaty between the big king and smaller people, like maybe some small town that he would take on as a vassal city. And what's interesting is they discovered that the format, particularly of the book of Deuteronomy, follows this outline of the same treaty almost to a T, which is interesting because liberal German scholars, especially in the 19th century, tried to argue, well, the book of Deuteronomy was the last of the book of Moses to be written. It was probably written around the time of Jeremiah, and then it was edited further after the captivity. So if you believe what they say, this book was written long after the time of Moses. But this treaty form did not continue to be a form that was used commonly during the period of time that they're saying the book was written. Clearly, it had to have been written earlier, and so it's an excellent argument for the book being of actual Mosaic origin, which is not to say that Moses wrote every word, because it discusses Moses' death at the end of the book. So there obviously was some shaping of the tradition, but the idea that it accurately reflects what Moses had to say, I think, is well-founded. So if you look at it from the outline of the treaty format, chapters 1 through 3 give us the preamble and the historical prologue, where it's basically saying, here's the history of our relationship, the big party and the small party. And then chapters 46 through 26 give the stipulations of the covenant relationship. Chapters 4 through 11 gives sort of a summary version. That's where you have the Ten Commandments. That's where you have the Shema, which is, Hear, O Israel, the Lord thy God, the Lord is one. That's the summary of what the Israelites were supposed to do. But then in chapters 12 through 26, it gives more details about what the people were expected to do. Then chapters 27 through 30 lays out the curses and the blessings, and then the ratification, of, you know, which was done with sacrifices of the treaty or the covenant relationship. And then chapters 31 through 34 talk about the succession arrangements between Moses, but also the invocation of a witness, which was God, and also the provision for public reading. So this treaty would be read on a periodic basis, which is exactly, if you look at a Hittite treaty, as I mentioned, this is the form of that treaty. Now, another way to look at this is in terms of the speeches that Moses gives. So in chapter 1, beginning with verse 6, through chapter 4, verse 43, that's Moses' first speech. And then chapter 4, beginning with verse 44, through chapter 26, verse 19, that's his second speech. And then 27 through 28 is the ratification of the covenant. And then 29 through 30 is the third speech. And then chapters 31 through 34, You have the conclusion, which have Moses' closing words. And then it also has the song of Moses, which there's the song of that we find right after the parting of the Red Sea, which in Orthodox hymnography, that's called the first biblical ode. So like when you hear the canon, you hear references to Moses parting the waters, crossing the Red Sea, when you hear the Irmos or the Katavasi of the first ode. The second ode is not normally sung, and that's because it's very penitential. And that second ode is what we're talking about here. And that's where Moses is telling the people, you know, you don't screw up, don't mess this up. So it's very penitential. So that second ode is only done liturgically during Lent. That's the only time you'll hear it in the services. And so like the canon of St. Andrew of Crete, you hear a second ode to that canon for that reason, because that is a penitential canon. And then we have the death of Moses. Now, the book of Deuteronomy is, as I said, not a difficult book to read. It's also interesting to note, if you look at what books did Christ quote from the most. Does anybody know which ones are the most ones he quoted the most? You can guess Deuteronomy is one of them, or wouldn't bring this up. But what name a couple of other books that you think might be candidates for this? Psalms is actually number one. That's the one he quotes the most. I think you might be referring to the book of Jude. Not Christ didn't quote from Enoch. Yeah, but Jude quotes from Enoch. He does quote from Genesis, but that's not one of the top four. But he does quote from Genesis a lot.
Didn't he quote from Proverbs as well?
He probably does. Isaiah is number three. Yep. So now we're left with two and four. So other than Deuteronomy, which one do you think would be the second or the fourth? Nope.
So Psalms, Isaiah, Deuteronomy, and...
Exodus. Exodus is number four. Deuteronomy is number two. So Deuteronomy is the second most quoted book by Christ. And so it's one that I think is you can easily gain something from it. There's a lot of low-hanging fruit in Scripture, and then there's the hard-to-get fruit. And Leviticus has a lot of hard-to-get fruit, but there is some low-hanging fruit in Leviticus, like do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Well, actually, not that one. It says love your neighbors yourself. That's in Leviticus. But a lot of it, to really understand it, you do have to dig deeper. So it's not the easiest book to read, but Deuteronomy had a lot of low-hanging fruit. A lot of it's not so difficult to understand. So anyway, as we go through these books, it would not be a bad thing in the intervening weeks for y'all to read these books so that you can take what you hear me talking about and see how it actually plays out when you read it. I've been learning a lot by preparing these classes, and I've been studying the Bible since I was a child, and I got a degree in it, so I've studied it a lot, but there's a lot that I've learned just by digging deeper. And as I mentioned, the book of Leviticus, I never really understood the structure of the book of Leviticus until I taught the class the last time. And it's a very important insight. And I record it, so you can listen to it online if you want to hear it. But it has a very tight structure to it. It talks about, ritual, priesthood, purity, the Day of Atonement. And so it's kind of making a progression. And the Day of Atonement is the focal point. And then on the other side of that, it's the reverse. Purity, priesthood, ritual. So there's a very tight structure to that book. But the Day of Atonement is really the focus. And what does the Day of Atonement point to? It points us to Christ. So Christ is the center of the law. So it's not... The unfortunate thing is a lot of Christians, even Orthodox Christians, unfortunately, will say, well, I don't mess with the Old Testament because that's for the Jews. Well, Christ quoted the law all the time. He quoted the prophets, and he opened the scriptures to the apostles. And you can't read the fathers and not read the Old Testament, because the fathers quote from it all the time. And it's not as easy as the New Testament to understand, but there's a lot there, and it's crucial for us to study it.